Looked at another way, what that really means is all of us are imperfect. We are all fundamentally imperfect, not because of this or that thing we've done wrong, but simply by being human, we are imperfect creatures of longing and error and mistakes. This is endemic to our nature. Now, once we recognize that and accept it with good grace, and this crops up in Buddhism too. You know, Buddhism says its first tenet is life is suffering. In other words, we are creatures that suffer. Now, once we accept our broken, suffering nature and put that on the table on an early dating scenario, that's a real relief. And indeed, in all interactions, I mean, all friendship, all genuine friendship begins the moment we take down the mask and we go, I'm suffering. This is difficult for me. Every time that you trade with somebody a piece of information that puts you in a vulnerable position and departs from the script that we're all given about what a successful life is, that's friendship. We're still not very good at friendship. It happens by accident. It's like stumbling on a city square late at night and you go, oh, how did I get there? In the morning, you can't find it again.
No, I agree.
But systematically, this is what we should do. That's how friendship begins, and that's how love begins.
My name is Jason Silva, and this is Flow Sessions. Flow Sessions is a series of mind-stretching conversations exploring the intersection of culture, art, technology, and altered states of consciousness. What does it mean to be human in an age of rapid change? What is the future of psychotherapy and mental health? What role will technologies play in our cultural evolution? What are the cognitive benefits of awe and wonder? Flow Sessions is presented by Flowcana, California's leading sustainable cannabis brand, working with independent craft farmers to transform agriculture the California way. Alain de Botton was born in Zurich, Switzerland in 1969 and now lives in London. He's a writer of essayistic books that have been described as a philosophy of everyday life. He's written on love, travel, architecture, and literature. His books have been bestsellers in 30 countries. Alain also started and helps to run a school in London called the School of Life, dedicated to a new vision of education. Alain's latest book, published in September 2019, is a collection of essays written for the School of Life titled The School of Life, An Emotional Education. Now, I've been a fan of Alain de Botton since like 1997. He is brilliant, eloquent, sensitive, captivating. He blows my mind. And it is such a thrill to bring this conversation to you guys. It is a true mind jam for the ages. And so without further ado, I present my conversation with Alain de Botton. Welcome to Flow Sessions.
Alain de Botton, hello.
Hello, such a pleasure.
Wow, I have been a fan for over 20 years.
It's amazing. It ages us both, but in a good way and for the noblest of reasons. So what a pleasure for me.
Yeah, I grew up in Venezuela. So I was reading The Art of Travel in the bathtub in like 1997, I remember. And the words were resonating so profoundly, even back then as a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
I want to salute you for the amazing impact that you have on people around the world with your just astounding reflections on the human condition. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. That's so kind. We'll end it there, right?
That's it. Thank you so much. Nice to see you.
Bye.
How are you?
Good.
Yeah.
You know, life is always, it's never stable.
There is
never a stable destination. There's always stuff coming in. There's always anxiety, incompleteness, desire.
Yes.
But that's okay. I mean,
that's okay.
I've learned to accept that. I've learned to accept that there is no destination.
So you are able to live with equanimity and grace in spite of the constant incompleteness of the human condition.
And even when there is no equanimity and no grace, I know it will return. I mean, you know, I don't want to set myself up. Sometimes people say things like, oh, wow, you know, I've read your stuff and you must be incredibly calm and wise. I'm like, no. You know, if you see me at the airport, like kicking my own suitcases and collapsing in tears, that's me, you know, and I want to own that, the demented guy, because I think that our madness is part of us. And I think to aspire to superior wisdom has to be compatible with checking in on an almost daily and hourly basis with one's insanity, one's idiocy, one's childlike nature, and the notion of the guru who is somehow always poised, you know, always appropriate is wrong. I've always been frightened of these people.
I have an allergy to gurus for the very same reason.
Okay, so
the self-righteousness feels like a total scam, you know, like they're not really showing themselves, because to show themselves would be to show me their suffering, their insecurity, their self-doubt, their fatalism, you know.
You just see on the other day, the Pope was caught slapping one of his well-wishers.
Yes.
And, you know, this is a major moment in civilization.
Absolutely.
Because there is the Pope caught on camera doing something which is, at one level, very human.
Yes.
And at the other level, not at all papal.
That's right.
And so that sets up, you know, this dichotomy between, you know, what do we think that someone can be and should be if they're living according to Christ, and actually what they are. And I think you could live according to Christ and lose your temper.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, one of my favorite philosophers, Montaigne, this was his big thing. What makes that philosopher so interesting is he's fascinated by our ordinary humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the first philosopher to talk about farting and shitting and sexual desire and appetites for radishes and carrots and, you know, the woman he's seen, you know, in the next castle and all the rest of it. This is a sensory, you know, there's a wonderful quote. He goes, "Kings and philosophers shit, and so do ladies."
Oh, well, you know, on that
that's
note,
a good one.
I have to pull up a quote for you because this reality of the human condition, the sort of the sacred and
the profane,
right? Or you know, Ernest Becker in The Denial of Death, which is a book that also resonated with me profoundly, talks about how us being gods with anuses, that we are simultaneously gods and worms.
Sure.
And since we're off to the races and already talking about shitting, there's a quote that he wrote that I want to read to you. He says that excreting, which is another word for taking a dump, is the curse that threatens madness, because it shows man his abject finitude, his physicalness, the likely unreality of his hopes and dreams. But even more immediately, defecation represents man's utter bafflement at the sheer nonsense of creation. To fashion the sublime miracle of the human face, the mysterium tremendum of radiant feminine beauty, the veritable goddesses that beautiful women are, to bring this all out of nothing, out of the void, and make it shine in noonday, to take such a miracle and put miracles again within it, deep in the mystery of eyes that peer out, the eye that gave even the dry Darwin a chill, to do all of this and to combine it with an anus that shits. It is too much. Nature mocks us, and the poets live in torture.
You just had this on your phone?
Yes.
You whip it out? No, I mean, it's beautiful. And you remember that bit in Milan Kundera's Unbearable Lightness of Being? He's the narrator, the hero, gets together with this woman, and in the middle of lovemaking, she needs to go to the bathroom and do a shit. And actually, it's a very moving thing, because he says, you know, if you love somebody, you're going to love them for that. You're going to love them for their humanity, because that's where the humanity is located.
Yeah.
And I think, well, no doubt we'll talk about love, but one of the things about love is accepting somebody in, you know, a range of moods and a range of registers, which is going to include going to the bathroom, and still loving them, you know, not just tolerating, but loving them. So that's something that we humans are not so good at. I mean, for thousands of years, we've not had a very good relationship with our bodies, right? We are self-divided creatures.
That's right.
Half the population is still, you know, unable to deal with certain basic facts about them, their own desires, their own needs, physical needs, etc. And I think that, you know, remember Kingsley Amis said that his sex drive was like being chained to an idiot. And there is something that we are all chained to idiots, but not just to one idiot. I mean, we're probably chained to a dozen idiots of all different kinds who've got these competing priorities.
That's right.
So to be a thinking person, to have intellectual ambitions, is always to be only a few millimeters away from the ridiculous, because we are being tugged in all sorts of other directions. You know,
this is what I have always found confounding about the human condition, because I'm so aesthetically oriented.
Mm-hmm.
I am attracted to things that resonate with my sensibility. I'm interested, as I think you are in many ways, in truth, in beauty, and what the French call frisante, you know, the skin orgasm. I like experiences that make the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I'm chasing radiance and awe. And you know, I think you summed it better than anyone when you said, you know, we don't cry when something is sad. We cry when something is more beautiful than we expected it to be. And Dawkins recently said, I don't cry when I'm sad. I cry when I'm moved.
Yep.
And I think it was Pico Iyer who said, we don't travel to move around. We travel in order to be moved. So there's this human sort of orientation around the sublime and the things that make us well up, that move us to tear, that move us beyond our animality.
But
then there's a very real thing, you know, yeah. Like the shit, the defecation, the animal, the entropy, the gravity, yeah. The death, yeah. The mortality. It's yeah. Like...
And also the sadness. I mean, the thing about beauty is that it's a well-known thing that people will start to cry more as they get older at certain simple but beautiful things. So, you know, if you show an 11-year-old, oh no, sorry, not an 11-year-old, a five-year-old. I used to have a five-year-old. It's now grown. But when I had a five-year-old, I would, you know, come back from a day in the city, you know, fighting among other humans and there were competing needs, etc. And I'd come to his bedroom and it was quiet and the light was dim yeah. And he was angelic. And, you know, we'd pick up a book about a little penguin looking for its mother, you know, among the ice floes of Antarctica.
Yeah.
And after a few pages of this, I would be in tears. And I had to hide these tears from him because he'd think, well, you know, my father's a madman. But the reason why it was so beautiful is that the emotions on the page were describing such simple but clear delineations of loyalty mm-hmm. and tenderness and kindness, all these things which in adult life are under such stress and mm-hmm. such short supply. I mean, mm-hmm. they are our true home. Mm-hmm. And so when you see your true home in a children's book or, you know, in a beautiful location, etc., you want to go, that's it, that's home. Mm-hmm. But it's disappearing. It's a mirage or it's you know, it's... And the older you get, the more you realize that, you know, those little islands of beauty and truth and kindness yeah. and justice, they're only ever going to be islands. You can't take permanent residence there. And that's why when you see something beautiful, you get that simultaneous experience of both pleasure and sadness and melancholy. I mean, the Japanese are so keen on this. The whole Japanese aesthetics is based around the melancholy you feel at knowing that something beautiful is only transient, including our own lives.
Well, this, I mean, this gets to the heart of my entire life. I mean, that's why I resonate so deeply with you. I'm a big fan of the director Cameron Crowe.
Yeah.
Do you know Cameron Crowe? Yeah. So he has this term that he uses called the happy sad.
Mm.
And the happy sad is the reason why he deploys usually just goosebump-inducing melancholy in his movies through his song choices, through yeah. the way a character might interact with another character with just a simple glance. And he often said making a movie is just an excuse to get into the editing room and set it to music, you know. And I learned this phrase, happy sad. It speaks so much to me. When I was, you know, 12 years old, 13 years old, I used to film family events. I already had a video camera. I would film family events, and then I would edit them with my dual-deck VCR, dub it from one to the other, and then I would add, like, the saddest possible song that I could find, you know? Yeah. I would find, like, Moon River from Breakfast at Tiffany's or the Auld Lang Syne, because yeah. I already was attuned to the feeling of sort of the melancholic and like wistful longing of the passing moment, right? What once was and is no longer. And yep. it just gripped me, you know, and it very quickly led me to an emotional release or a cathartic release.
Yep.
But it doesn't mean that I was at peace with the moment ending, but I had at least grieved through it, you know, enough to move on with my yeah. day. But, you know, you say that people start to get more sad at beautiful, simple things when they get older. You know, I've been like that since I was like
right.
13
You're advanced.
Years old.
You're advanced. No, but of course. I mean, think of flowers,
yeah.
right? Like, no, I mean, maybe you, but very few 11-year-olds are enchanted by flowers. But there are very few 70-year-olds who are not enchanted by flowers. Like yeah. every 70-year-old yeah. I've ever met
yeah.
is like keen on gardening. Mm. Now, why is that? It's because this symbol of, you know, beauty in a perfect, you know, miniature form and this evidence of new life and the modesty of the kind of the beauty that a flower betokens. Yeah. All of this is profoundly touching when your own mortality is very much in sight. And, you know, if you think of Islamic pottery or Chinese porcelainware, you know, these guys were just painting beautiful little flowers again and again and again. Yeah. And think of the fear of death. These are also violent regimes. Life was tough.
Oh, yeah.
Life was difficult. But what did they want to put on a table? Mm. Just a beautiful, finely crafted thing with lots of, you know, line of little flowers on it. Mm-hmm. And I love the gravity and the seriousness. I mean, Van Gogh, just shortly before he took his life, attempted to take his life, you know, he was painting flowers again and again and again.
Yeah.
What was it about these flowers that was drawing him at those darkest, most troubled moments? So when people say, oh, I like flowers, you think, oh, sentimental, you know, must have had a cheerful life and never known suffering at all.
Yeah.
No, it's those who suffer most who I think are alive most to those little islands. But, you know, it could be a flower. It could be lots of other things.
I mean, that's art. When you talk about museums, it should be like secular temples or like secular churches. And I think it was the architecture of happiness that you first started to get into this, that we can design spaces, that the power of art and architecture to move us, you know, that it is those of us that are most maybe acquainted with pain that are then more sensitive to certain works of beauty and certain works of art, certain buildings that can just like immediately move us to tears.
Totally, totally. And if I can just sidetrack, I mean, back to the museums in a minute, but sidetrack to love on this.
Yeah.
I mean, if two lovers meet for the first time and one of them says, you know, hey, my life's great and I'm really kind of advancing towards new peaks of satisfaction and accomplishment, like that is a really hard person to feel close to. But if somebody says, you know, despite, you know, my active life, etc., often I feel broken, I feel sad, I feel that I'm lost. You know, wow, this is somebody you can love and can let yourself be loved by. So, you know, behind intimacy, there is the revelation of brokenness.
Pain. I mean, is that why I'm always attracted to the wounded feminine? Or is it where we all are?
Well, I think we should be. Well, first of all, let me put it like this. We are all wounded. I mean, Christianity and Buddhism saw this way ahead of time. You know, for Christianity and indeed Judaism, we are all the inheritors of the sins of Adam and Eve. We are all original sinners. Now, you could go, whoa, that's serious and that's horrible and that's punitive. And it does have that quality. However, looked at another way, what that really means is all of us are imperfect. We are all fundamentally imperfect, not because of this or that thing we've done wrong, but simply by being human, we are imperfect creatures of longing and error and mistakes. This is endemic to our nature. Now, once we recognize that and accept it with good grace, and this crops up in Buddhism too. You know, Buddhism says its first tenet is life is suffering. In other words, we are creatures that suffer. Now, once we accept our broken, suffering nature and put that on the table, on an early dating scenario, that's a real relief. And indeed, in all interactions, I mean, all friendship, all genuine friendship begins the moment we take down the mask and we go, I'm suffering. This is difficult for me. Every time that you trade with somebody a piece of information that puts you in a vulnerable position and departs from the script that we're all given about what a successful life is, that's friendship. We're still not very good at friendship. It happens by accident. It's like stumbling on a city square late at night and you go, oh, how did I get there? In the morning, you can't find it again.
No, I
but
agree.
Systematically, this is what we should do. That's how friendship begins and that's how love begins.
I agree 100%. It reminds me of that Timothy Leary quote about find the others. And he says that, you know, most of us rely on club passwords like, how you doing? Good. How you doing? Good. That's a real one figure in America. What we really long to say things like, what are you afraid of? How are you broken?
Yep.
You know, what makes you cry?
And that how are you mad?
Yeah.
How are you crazy?
How are you nuts?
What are you afraid of at 3 a.m.?
That's right. And that's a really big thing, you know, and
you know, we do a thing at the School of Life, which where we gather, when we have like a big event, we'll gather people sometimes and to break the ice, we'll say to people, look, turn to a stranger on left or right and say to them something you regret, something you're ashamed of, and something you're afraid of. Just turn to them and do that with them now.
I love this exercise.
And it works unfailingly that just by those simple commands from the stage, it transforms the atmosphere in a room.
Yeah.
And you can be doing it with a group of CEOs who are completely guarded. They've swallowed the American success story. But suddenly something, another door opens, yeah. and it's a beautiful thing to see. And it's, you know, it's such an irony. We spend so much of our energy trying to impress others when really what we need is a sense of communion with others, which is not based on impressing them. To impress another person is also to shut them off. It's to close off our humanity from theirs. And so our success-oriented culture is fundamentally unlinked with our emotional aspirations to connect with other humans.
You are such a beautiful speaker.
You are.
I love hearing you go on. You know, there's a bunch of quotes, actually, you know, phrases from several of your books that have resonated for years. You know, something else I'm interested in is human truth, mm-hmm. and the importance of finding some distinction between objective truth and how you call it poetic truth, you know, or Bruno Latour talks about modes of existence, you know, or Chronos and Kairos in terms of the Greeks, different ways of interpreting reality, interpreting time. There's like mechanized cognition, reality by the clock, and then there's like subjective poetic reality, the truthful fictions in which we live and so on and so forth. And I remember this one line that you said that something to the degree of a journalist may be more accurate in describing the details of an event than a poet, but a poet may nevertheless reveal truths of a deeper sort that are beyond the literal grid.
Sure. I mean, you know, this
What is this space beyond the literal grid? Well, is that a real space?
Yes. I mean, you know, think of when Picasso he painted Gertrude Stein in a fractured cubist way. And people said, it doesn't look like Gertrude Stein. And he famously answered, it will. and in other words, that he was seeing
something. It will, that's brilliant.
He was seeing something in her that later would become clear. Or Francis Bacon said as well, you know, when you're painting somebody, it's often the so-called distorted element will get closer to the truth mm-hmm. than the literal truth. And it's in that way that, you know, as we were saying, you know, the poet might go ahead of the journalist in grasping something important. You know, it comes down to something we were just talking about it before we went on air about academia.
Yeah.
You know, academia is wedded to a rather naive scientific model of, you know, the truth.
Right.
And so when academics are tackling subjects, they'll tend to proceed in, you know, as if there is a way of being utterly faithful to a phenomenon, not realizing that a poet might rush ahead of them and get, you know, get there in three stanzas where they've been laboring for years with a certain kind of approach.
Right. And so do you think that obviously we need both, right? We need a kind of objective, compliant consensus reality, but we also need the reality of personal experience because we get so much nourishment from that. That's the mythopoetic, that's the liminal, that's the dreamlike, that's the meaning-making spaces of humans. But do you think when we blur the lines that divide those domains is when we get into trouble? So it's like when people have an interior experience that's true for them, but they want it to be true for everybody else.
Yes,
that turns it turns poetic truth into scripture and into guruhood and into like a post-truth world where, you know, opinions are like assholes and everybody has one, but they're claiming that their opinion is the truth. You know, so how do we make sure that we keep that line of intent? Because, you know, obviously, you know, I hosted a TV show on National Geographic called Brain Games, all about the objective reality of how the brain works and this and that. But like so much of the stuff that I explore in my videos and in my art, I'm interested in the ineffable interior landscapes. You know, I'm interested in like, well, you wrote about it in The Art of Travel, is those moments where how pleasant to hold in mind through the crevices of our moods at 3 p.m. when lassitude and despair threaten that there is always an airplane taking off for somewhere, Baudelaire's, anywhere. Like, what is that? Like, what does that have to do with objective reality? But that's a feeling I resonate, I connect with. It's true for me.
Yeah.
It's obviously true for you.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's all context appropriate and context specific. I mean, I had an example of this the other day. I was just flying back from Abu Dhabi on Etihad Airways. Etihad Airways is owned by one of the major sheikhs.
On the residence?
One of the major sheikhs. No, I didn't fly in the residence. But, you know, I was surprised that shortly before takeoff, we had an Arabic prayer. Uh-huh. And And I thought, you know, let's not pray this thing gets off the ground. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's not pray that we get to our destination. Let's do some sums. Let the guys at Airbus and the yes. well-trained pilots
yes.
apply science and reason to get yes. this bird over to London.
Yes.
And then prayer has another place. And I think that, you know, the two, you know, should exist in separate realms, church and state. But
church and state, that's exactly how I feel about it. You know, Ursula Le Guin has a great line also in this. As you can tell, this is a subject that has captured my mind. But she says, science describes accurately from the outside. Poetry describes accurately from the inside. Science explicates, poetry implicates. Yeah. Both celebrate what they describe. I mean, that's like yeah. spot on. I mean, your example of the airplane is 100%. I fly a lot. And like you, I marvel at these birds. You know, that there's that passage from The Art of Travel when you talk about what like Leonardo yeah. might have thought if he flew in yeah. a modern plane. And then he looked out the window and he said, we're flying through a cloud, you know? Like, and then most people just close the shutter and complain that. So it's like, yeah, you want mathematics. You want like all these equations and these engineers that worked for 30 years, mechanical engineers, to design these reliable machines. You don't want to pray that the airplane takes yeah. off.
But then again, you know, I was in an observatory in Spain, in the Canary Islands a little while ago. And, you know, I was with a tour guide and they were spending a lot of time trying to explain the difference between this galaxy and this constellation and this, okay. that, and the other. And I was thinking, look, you know what? I'm here. I just want the general picture. I don't need to know, you know, that it's Kepler 34b or Kepler 33b. I am not an astronomer.
Right.
And therefore, my interest in this is humanistic
yes.
and poetic,
yes.
not scientific. And I think that sometimes, you know, those who are in charge of the sciences, who are building science museums, natural history museums, you know,
they
places
that.
For, because you know, they forget That's that right. the average person is interested in it, you know, in a poetic sense, not in a scientific sense. They don't need to know every last detail. They want to know, you know, when the Stoics, mm-hmm. Stoics were some of the, what I love about the Stoics of ancient Rome is that they were spectacularly bad at studying the stars. Like uh-huh. they made various studies and they got it all wrong. Huh. However, they almost admitted that their real interest lay not in discovering the nature of the stars in the universe, but in using the spectacle of the universe to bring calm to their souls. And so from that point of view, they succeeded.
Yeah.
But I think the West has become a little bit confused about what yeah. its priorities are. And I think that most of us who are outside of the scientific community do need science, but we need to look at it in the way that yeah. we normally operate, which is through a humanistic lens. Yeah. So what do we need to know from the stars? We need to know that we're very, very small.
Yeah.
Do we need to know for that every last detail? No, we don't. We just need to be awed
oh, yeah.
in a proper way. We don't need to know every last detail. And when we look at, you know, natural history museums and we see, you know, this bone came from this area of Siberia, etc., you know, after a certain point, often these guys are laboring us with details that we don't need because
yeah.
the message is general rather than specific.
Right.
In their work, they need to know the details.
Oh, for sure.
We don't need to know that
so
detail.
So I think so. So both are necessary, and it just
Absolutely.
Depends on the audience. You know, it's like yep. if you think of the film Contact with Jodie Foster, you know, she's this wonderful scientist, but she's also a wonder junkie, mm-hmm. and all the science, and they get the message from the aliens, and they build a ship, and it's, you know, it's beautiful, it's sublime, it's mathematics, it's, oh my God, the truth of science, and it builds the wormhole, and she goes to the other end of the galaxy, and she witnesses a celestial event, and then what does she say? They should have sent a poet.
Yep.
They should have sent a poet, you know? There is this marvelous article written by a guy called Ross Anderson. I don't know if I ever sent it to you. Yeah. It's called GoldenEye, uh-huh. and it's about the Hubble Space Telescope mm-hmm. and the images that it took of the deep field. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I loved about that piece is he talked about the metaphysical and philosophical power, the philosophical wonderment evoked by the deep field images. So even though those images were taken by a sublime instrument of science, everything about the Hubble is science. But then what does the Hubble do? It mainlines space and time through the optic nerve, right? Through the sheer aesthetic force of its discoveries, the Hubble distills the complex abstractions of astrophysics into singular expressions of color and light, vindicating Keats' famous couplet, beauty is truth, truth is beauty. There you go.
That's right. That's beautiful. And you know, part of the problem is that because this distinction is not alive in our minds, we miss out on a whole range of aesthetic experiences. For example, flight.
Yes.
So when people go in an airplane,
yes,
they are not prepared to have an aesthetic experience because
right.
they have been told that they are going through a scientific, you know, journey yeah. to yeah. another land, and that's
right.
it.
That's right.
And then, you know, artists, you know, bless them, are kind of trying to catch up and
yeah.
trying sometimes in the narrower space of the museum,
yeah.
trying to sometimes recapture some of those feelings. But we need to be readier to see the aesthetic in areas where we think it's merely material and scientific.
Yes. And I think for that to happen, we have to pierce our representations, right? Because as we grow from children to adults, we start to create these maps of how the world works mm. in our brain. And then we rely on those maps. And for the most part, that serves us well, so we can commute to work and so on and so forth. But eventually we forget that the map is not the territory. And the territory yeah. is far more interesting and has so much more to it than just the utilitarian function of those maps. And
Which
so how do we do that? You know, Michael, sorry to interrupt you, mm. Michael Pollan, who wrote this new book about psychedelic psychotherapy, he has this great passage. He was writing about cannabis, the marijuana, the texture of the subjective experience of cannabis. And he says that what it does is it evokes a sense of first sight unencumbered by knowingness. Mm. So the knowingness or the jadedness or I know what that is,
yep.
dismisses what's there and leapfrogs to the conclusion. It goes straight to the concept. But yep. that occasionally, that virginal noticing of the sensate world, that sense of first sight unencumbered by knowingness mm. is, it catalyzes awe and wonder. You need to forget what you know
yep.
in order to see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower and so on and so
yes,
forth.
Yes, and it's, you know, it's the paradox that if we were constantly amazed and our senses were constantly alive, we couldn't get through the day.
That's
so
right.
the capacity to be habituated,
that's
or
right.
to be unaware
yes.
is a survival strategy.
100%.
At the same time, it's a killing strategy.
That's right.
So we have to get it right. And
oh,
that's
you
why,
got it.
You know, so many of those moments when we step outside the known
yeah.
Of our daily lives. And it could be, I mean, a favorite thing is being awake at an odd time of day or night. So, you know, if you wake up at 3 a.m. and you go to the kitchen,
strange.
Right, and you look at the kitchen, wow, how weird the kitchen is. There's this thing called the fridge. What's it doing?
That's right.
You know, there's a bowl of fruit on the sideboard. What is that? What is a banana? At 3 in the morning, a banana is like a spectral event. I
yeah.
mean, it's crazy.
That's right.
Being ill. You know, when you're recovering from an illness, let's imagine that, you know, your sinuses have been
yeah,
blocked,
yeah.
you've been laboring under a fever for a few days, and then that mood is lifting, and
yeah.
suddenly you're back into the world, and it's like being born again.
100%.
So there are, and you know, drugs are another version, but for me, drugs are only one mm-hmm. of a category of motions and potions that you can take
yeah.
In order to break the spell of habit.
Yeah, no doubt. He says, what is banality and boredom?
Who's he? Sorry.
Sorry, Michael Pollan also.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this is exactly what you said.
Yeah.
He says, what is banality and boredom except techniques that the educated mind deploys against experience so that it can get through the day without being continually exhaustingly astonished?
Right.
And so that's fine for maybe like, I call it like default world, like fetching water and chopping wood.
Yeah.
But we must make room for the ritual, aesthetic, and mythopoetic domains. Like we
yep.
need to make the magic circle, and we need to carve that as something that we need a couple times a week, the same
yep.
way we need food a couple times a day.
That's right. That's right. And to recognize that about yourself. And
yes.
for Proust, who I spent a lot of time reading and thinking about, that the thing that does that first and foremost is art.
Yes.
Now I think that's too much of a kind of classic 19th century French way of looking at things. I think the realm of art is perhaps larger. It's not just a painting that you see. Of course, great works of art do this, but as I say, it can also be, you know, falling in love,
mm-hmm.
Recovery from an illness,
mm-hmm.
Insomnia, you know, taking an airplane, traveling of all kinds. I mean, you know, why do we like to travel? We like to travel because you're forced when traveling to break through the veil of habit.
That's
and to
right.
see, you know, once anew the kind of wonder of the world that, you know, that is dull.
Absolutely. I mean, and people have always, I have often said that like falling in love becomes a deliberate act of aestheticizing reality.
Yes.
You know, like I am deliberately raising this to an aesthetic domain. And people call it, well, you shouldn't idealize people. And I'm like, no, actually, it's the opposite. You know, what's delightful about falling in love is the idea and the sort of idealizing the entire rhapsodic stage play that you're creating. Like, let's go here together. Let's go to that restaurant that's decorated in that way. Let's listen to this song together. Let's run through the forest together. Like, let's create an enchanted realm together. Ernest Becker called it a cosmology of two.
Right. I mean, the people who do this always and very naturally over many years are parents of their children. I mean, parents are continuously in love with their children.
Yes.
And, you know, they'll go, oh my God, you know, the kid drew a picture of the skull, and they're like, oh wow, that's amazing.
Or, it's not that amazing. You
know, the kid ate an egg or whatever, and they are permanently in love.
Yeah.
But we also know this from adult love. I mean, there's that wonderful feeling when you first fall in love with somebody and, I don't know, they take you home.
Yes.
And, you know, they open the front door and suddenly it's their home. And it's like, wow, they're their shoes. And like, and they've got some books on their shelf. And then they show you their bathroom. And it's like, really? That's your soap?
Their world.
And it's their world.
Their photos on their fridge of their life. And you're like, oh, you've had such a poetic life.
Yeah, exactly.
And I like your life.
Right. So now one view is to say, that's idealized. That's a myth. And that's going to disappear within 3 weeks. However, we could flip it around and go, no.
That's
the truth. That is how God looks. You know, we don't believe in God. I don't believe in God. But, you know, if we were holy men, that is what God would see.
That's
the holiness and preciousness of every single human that's ever lived.
No doubt.
But outside of a lover in the first 3 weeks or a parent, we don't normally get that. But we should. And it's almost, you know, we need to be jogged into that. And I think that's what people have always looked to drugs, to religion, to art.
Technologies of ecstasy.
Technologies. You're faster at this than me.
But
you've charted this territory. So,
well, I think I'm interested in the deliberate hacking of our subjectivity.
Right.
There's a guy called Eric Davis. He wrote a book called Technosis, Myth, Magic, and Mysticism in the Age of Information. You would love him. Mm-hmm. He's been on the podcast. I'll send you the episode. But he talks about experience design. And now we're living, of course, in the experience economy, because now, you know, the whole idea is like, as advances in psychology, which you know a lot about, technology, neurobiology, and also pharmacology are all advancing. So it's giving us this capacity to steward the contents of lived experience in a way we never have before. So we're talking about directly engaging the technical material of subjectivity itself. That means designer ecstatic radiance, designer aesthetic ecstasy. But even the idea of having some kind of agency over this experience has governed my life. Like, that's like kind of what I want. It doesn't mean I need to feel that way all the time, because I agree with you. We get depleted. But I don't want to feel like it's this haphazard thing that once in a while the light shines through the trees and I can get some of that grace. But I want that grace to be something I can get in a reproducible manner,
of course,
once in a while.
The people, that's beautiful. The people who thought hardest about designing this for millions of people were, of course, religions.
Yes.
I mean, religions are structured routes to feelings of ecstasy, transcendence, community, etc., the noumenal. And when we did away with religion, apart from just doing away with certain ideas about how the world was formed and what would happen to us after we died, we lost touch with all of this stuff.
That's right.
And I know you're interested in this. I'm very interested in this. But, you know, we are living properly in a post-religious age. And what does that really mean? And I think we need to make sure that our lives have got a lot of what religious lives used to have, outside of the, you know, the supernatural bit, but very much around, particularly around transcendence and community.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, we need regular reminders of everything that exceeds us in an ecstatic way rather than a dispiriting way.
Because
one of the terrible things is that when we come into full awareness of the smallness of our egos and the insignificance of our lives, this is normally experienced in modern individualistic society as a root of despair.
That's right.
And that's crazy. We need to flip that round.
That's right.
This should be seen as the beginning of something beautiful. Of course, our insignificance, rather than being something we kind of glimpse out of the corner of our eye, the fact we are insignificant can be redeemed if it's set within a broader context.
No doubt. Where, the narrative and the interpretive framework matters. Yeah. You know, I mean, Carl Sagan said, you know, for small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love. You know, like, that's kind of beautiful. He also said, we are a way for the cosmos to know itself, which is a bit more empowering. And then Neil deGrasse Tyson goes even further and he says, look, when I see how big the universe is and I see myself, but I know that the atoms in my bodies were cooked in the furnaces of stars, and the atoms in my right, in my left arm were probably cooked in the different furnace of a different star than the atoms in my right hand. So when I see the universe, I don't feel small. I feel big.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So how do we interpret a narrative that serves
yeah.
us?
Yeah. And also that might in a certain mood enable us to greet our own death with less than horror.
Yeah.
That we would almost be able to surrender back to, you know, celestial space from whence we came, with a certain grace, because we think I'm going home, rather than my ego is dissolving.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, this was always the Buddhist way.
Yeah.
That rather than trying to say, you know, the ego's dissolution is a tragedy, it is actually the beginning of a kind of return to truth, which is that we're always belonged to the universe, and we're just returning there. Very, very hard. I mean, there's a part of our brains that really resist that idea.
Doubt.
But our brains are complicated machines,
right.
and we can, without deluding ourselves, I think, talk ourselves into greater acceptance for the inevitability.
And it's very interesting, because this, what you're saying, is exactly the one of the incidental effects of people who have high dose psychedelic experiences in guided settings. They have a mystical experience. And William James, the psychologist, he had all this criteria that if you met all these things, you know, transcendence of time and space, a sense of the noetic, deeper poetic truth beyond the literal grid, a sense of like ravishing well-being, and you had these experiences that met the criteria for a mystical experience. And people who have a mystical experience, who up until that point maybe were suffering from treatment-resistant depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, which, by the way, all of them are the same in the brain. It's over-rumination and excessive self-consciousness. It's an ego whose patterns of thinking have calcified, and so you're stuck in like negatively reinforced patterns of thought. And that these psychedelic mystical experiences shake the snow globe effectively. Yep. And so those grooves get dissolved. And then people feel a direct encounter with the other, with the grand other. And when they come out, and for years afterwards, they're no longer afraid of death.
But I think in order to do that, we need a roadmap. I mean, you can't just put somebody on the edge of the Grand Canyon and say, get on with it.
No.
We need, I mean, religions knew that there were these things called rituals.
Integration.
So you have to kind of create the experience. Yeah. I mean, I always think that humans are very easily suggestible. In other words, our behavior is very guided by what we're meant to think and feel at any point in any given context. Think of an art gallery. Mm-hmm. When you walk into an art gallery, it just says, you know, art gallery above the door, and suddenly you behave like in an art gallery. You go silent, you put your arms next to you, and you look with great intent at things on the wall. If somebody said, actually, it's not an art gallery, this is actually, you know, I don't know, a public space of some kind, a railway station, people
behavior
go, oh, right.
would change.
Behavior would change. So our behavior is so context dependent.
Yeah, and we're easily mediated.
Yeah.
But that's a good thing.
That's a good thing, except that unfortunately, there are not very many interesting goals at the moment out there in society. I mean, if you said, look, I'm looking for a transcendental experience, you know, I've come to your country and I'm looking for transcendental, like, what? This is not available here.
Right.
We have a water park and we have a safari,
that's right.
But we don't know what you mean.
That's right.
So we don't even know that language. I mean, think of the average five-star hotel, right? Mm-hmm. The world is dotted with five-star hotels. They are supposed to be the peak of civilization's attempt to create happiness in another human being.
That's right.
You show up at a five-star hotel and you go, right, so I'm looking for deeper forms of happiness, connection, meaning, etc. I mean, you would be shown out of the building.
Yeah.
They don't know what that means.
Yeah.
So, and that's indicative, not of a problem, you know, in hostelry, but it's a problem in modern materialistic society. Mm-hmm. We don't have our higher psychological needs sufficiently in view. We don't have a language in which to talk about them. You know, if you went to a museum and you said, I'm here to, you know, reconnect with my soul and reconfigure my vision, you would be thrown out.
Yeah.
If you went to the Oxford or Cambridge philosophy department and you said, you know, I'm here to discover, you know,
my
the
soul.
Ecstatic and the noumenal and my soul,
again, they also you kick would be, you out.
So that's telling us something.
Yeah.
It's telling us that in many, many contexts, things that are eminently reasonable and found a place for thousands of years within the organized structures of religions are now deemed close to insanity.
Mm-hmm.
So no wonder we have a problem with what we call mental health.
Yeah, because people have no spaces for it.
Have no spaces. 100%. So a lot of people are being shunted into that space called you're ill.
You know, it's so interesting to hear you say that, because I just hear myself, like I've always said, I'm like, I wish that I could rent a Gothic cathedral and stage design my own like ecstatic encounter.
Okay.
I want to play Hans Zimmer music and require everybody to take three hits of a strong THC joint before they walk in, you know, to make themselves more porous, more suggestible, and have an ecstatic.
Jason.
Yes.
As you say this beautiful idea, there's a slightly ironic smirk on your lips. Smile on your lips. Yeah. As though this was a crazy idea. This is a very sane idea.
Yeah.
This needs to happen.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that's happened is that people who know how to organize stuff, who know how to build cathedrals, organize large numbers of people, deal with money, they're all in one camp, and mm-hmm. they tend to have a rather flattened view of life. Mm-hmm. And those who dream and those mm-hmm. who have the visions are reduced to podcasting and making little films like me writing book. I'm putting myself in this category, We don't have the practical confidence to reach out to these guys and to create what I think religions always did, which was to marry up the material and procedural and bureaucratic side of life with spiritual ambition.
No doubt.
And I think that my hope for the 21st century is that we're going to go and do more of that so that you will start your cathedral. And I want to go there. I want to be one of the first guests.
No doubt.
There.
Well, you've written the manuals. Architecture of Happiness, The Art of Travel on Love, The Consolations of Philosophy, How Proud's Gonna be. You literally, since over 20 years.
I know, but so look, shall I tell you we're at the beginning of 2020. Shall I tell you my ambitions now for the rest of my life?
Yes.
Okay. So my ambition. So I started the School of Life, but what I really, really want to do is I want to start a community. I want to start a kind of, I'm really interested in monasticism. Monasticism sits on top of Epicureanism. Mm-hmm. Epicureanism was the first attempt in Greco-Roman society to bring people together around shared values, community, love, kindness, the pursuit of truth. They built a little miniature society where you would retreat from the big city and you'd live among friends committed to these goals.
Yeah.
I remember reading this when I was 25 thinking, this is not possible. These guys were writing about this and this is a dream. You know, the guy who did his PhD thesis on Epicurus was Karl Marx. Communism is a state-run, authoritarian, and rather dispiriting version of Epicureanism. Mm. Epicureanism is much more charming. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the reason I'm telling you this is it would be fantastic to start a network of communities dedicated to some of the stuff we've been talking about.
Oh, I love
where you wouldn't just check in every now and then on a YouTube film. You wouldn't just, come around. You would actually shape your life that way. Mm-hmm. We were talking about your nomadic lifestyle, right? Many of us, what are our options in the modern world? We're given an option of two things, a standard career and a, family with 2.2 children in the suburbs, right? That is what it means to be normal. And for many of us, it doesn't quite work. We want to hang out in a network of friends. We want to have our lives guided by certain values, et cetera. Where do we go? How do we do this? And
you become a digital native and you live around the world. I know,
but that's very, very hard for most people.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The thing that frustrates me about tech, as I'm sure it frustrates you, these guys are all the time bringing inventiveness to bear on pretty small problems or pretty banal problems. It's like, yes, it's good to be able to get a map to order you a fried chicken in the middle of the night. Great, fantastic. Or measure your pulse, etc. But the really big challenges and the really big things that drag our lives down are around disconnection, being cut off from the transcendent, being cut off from meaning, etc.
That's right.
Now, imagine if we were trying to hack some ways into setting up big solutions to these problems.
Yeah.
And we brought the engines of capitalism and the engines and the disciplines of bureaucracy and commerce to bear on these things.
Yeah.
If we built a network of temples that replaced the religious structures of old and were places where we would go in order to look at the stars and get in touch with our own smallness in a structured and beautiful way. What if we were able to employ artists, the great artists who used to work in the service of religion and now tend to work merely in the service of their own egos.
Yeah.
And if we harnessed them and their creative powers to a bigger mission, and went to the musicians and we said, instead of merely talking about those early moments of love, if you took your musical genius and made that in the service of the transcendent and the noumenal and ultimate meaning and created something to rival, Bach's Mass in B minor, then again, we would be getting somewhere to a new stage. So my goal is...
Goosebumps.
Right. So my goal is, can we try and move from, you and I, we know the theory.
Yeah.
Can we advance over the coming decades into the practice?
Have you been to Burning Man?
I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
It
took me a long time before I went.
Did you like it?
And now I've been twice.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of the difficulty in getting there and in getting comfortable is makes it very self-selecting.
Right.
So it's pilgrimage and it's hard. And even once you're there, sometimes it's hard with the dust and the heat and this and that. But there are some moments, at sunset or sunrise, you have to realize the art is built for ecstatic encounters.
Okay.
And it's a juxtaposition of just insane art.
But Jason, why are we talking only about one Burning Man? We need 1,000 Burning Man.
Yeah, sure, sure. But 70,000 people build a city for a week for that experience.
It's fantastic and good for them. Yeah, yeah. But we need more of this.
Yes,
and in a way, when people always talk to me about Burning Man, it's like that's the only thing the planet has managed to do in this area. We need something for the guys who can't leave their families and their jobs for weeks to go on a pilgrimage, but who are able to do this just on a Thursday night, among their friends and that kind of thing. So we need so much inventiveness around ritualizing and structuring the kind of spiritual, psychological dimension of life.
No,
and
no doubt.
We're at the beginning of working out what to do. And I think I've always been struck by the divide between the artist who has the vision but can't hold a pen, do anything practical in life, and the practical people who are terrifically practical but are so neutral about the ends to which their practical skills are put. And I have people in business and they're like, I'm like, do you want to change the world? And they go, no, I just want to make some money. And you want to go, really? That's such a, I don't know, it's such a peculiar end given that life is so finite.
I can totally relate.
So we want to try and connect those things.
Yeah, it's so interesting because that's what religion sort of used to be. I mean, that's what the church, that's the mosque, that's the temple. I mean, the buildings speak to that intention still. And I'm not sure if there was a time when cinema, maybe art house cinemas, also were about that. When I love cinema, so when I go to the movies, I am in a reverential state already. Like, I am ready to sit in the dark and see the light. Literally, I am ready to experience truth 24 times per second. I'm ready to experience art as the lie that reveals the truth. But what has happened, now with the criticism of Marvel films, they're like entertainment theme parks instead of like art, or that's what some people are saying, is that you go to the movie theater and it's like all you see now is Coca-Cola commercials, popcorn and kids making noise, and like 30 minutes of commercials before the movie starts.
And also then the movie is not as good as it should be. And the reason is not that people are more stupid than they ever were, but that we haven't set the priorities. What is cinema for?
Exactly.
We haven't really properly, it's still a kind of form of luck of like, oh, that was a good film or that was a bad film. We don't even know why.
Right.
I mean, I think you ought to start with the subject matter. What are we trying to get these films to do to us?
Oh, I will tell you exactly. Gene Youngblood wrote a book called Expanded Cinema in the 70s. And he said, cinema reflects mankind's historical drive to manifest his consciousness outside of his mind in front of his eyes.
Okay.
So when we watch a film, where consciousness meets its own process.
Okay, so this should be written on the Hollywood Hills.
Oh, no doubt.
Below the sign.
No doubt.
And when these guys, show up to work every day, it's like, what are we doing? What are we looking for the next hit? No. You're looking to
mirror consciousness.
That's what you do. So when you're making a film about a married couple, you're trying to mirror the consciousness of marriage.
No doubt.
When you're trying to make a film about gangsters, you mirror, et cetera, et cetera.
No doubt. And also because, even you think of when you stare at a screen, you're not staring at a screen. You're staring into a screen. Mm-hmm. A close-up of a gifted actor, you're not seeing their face up close. You're looking into their soul, right? So at its best, that's what it is. It's you kind of assume the viewpoint. You enter some kind of altered state, which is a very powerful thing. But there's a guy called Hugo Murstenberg back in like the 1910s or something, who was already saying that cinema works more like the mind than like objective reality.
But I think we know, right, that cinema is underperforming to its mission.
Yes.
And part of the reason is that we're terrifically confused about what it's for.
Correct.
And the great ages of cinema were always those in which the true possibilities of cinema were foremost in producers' and directors' minds. And that's why, France produced a golden age of cinema. It no longer can because it's now confused about what it's doing.
Right.
Russia produced the golden age of cinema. And the same is true, by the way, of painting or any other art form. It's not the technical skill that distinguishes an art form. And when you get renaissances, it's not that suddenly there were lots of geniuses at a technical level. No. It's the people knew what the art was for.
That's right.
That's what, it's a slightly strange theory, but that's ultimately what creates so-called geniuses in art. The reason why, France hasn't produced a single painter of note in the last 150 years, whereas previous to that, it produced something like 300 painters of note. This wasn't some genetic distribution of genius. This was to do with the fact that we're now not sure what we want to get out of painting. So this is where intellectuals have a heavy role to play, that we should be helping these guys because there's lots and lots of technically talented people, but they don't know what they're supposed to be doing.
Yes.
So we need to set the agenda. Thinkers need to set the agenda for creatives. Mm. If you leave it up to creatives, most creatives, unfortunately, are not so good at thinking.
That's right.
And in the great ages of art, it was actually other people who would do the thinking for the artists and would help them along. Mm. So
that is just sublime. Thank you. It's not. I feel like it's so wonderful to hear you speak because you've clearly thought this through and you're so on it. You know, well, I hope that you continue to kind of continue to scale.
But Jason, you know, this is why we need collaboration.
Yeah, let's collaborate.
Let's collaborate. You know, we need to collaborate, and we need the people who are going to watch this and listen to this.
Yes.
To come and join us.
Yes.
And collaborate with us.
Yes.
You know, we don't know where this is going to go, but it might go to 200,000 people around the world.
No doubt.
And somewhere people will be going, you know what? I want to help on this. Mm-hmm. You know, let's build some things that will replace churches. Mm-hmm. Let's build some things, some community centers that will actually bring communities together in a new way.
Oh, for sure.
Let's make, you know, something that can replace a monastery and bring the highest ideals of, you know, love together in an institution. You know, we need all of this.
Yeah.
And or indeed, how let's reinvent cinema.
Yeah. For sure. I mean, look, another example is theater, you know, at its best. I remember watching the 20th anniversary or 25th anniversary concert of Les Mis, and it was recorded, and you know, all the actors, they all performed the songs, and they had like multiple choirs behind them. It was ecstatic. And the very end, the crescendo song that ends the play, was like literally God, even for the non-believer, right? Like, but it was like, okay, I don't really believe in traditional God, but that's God. And they would film the audience, and everybody's crying, and everybody's just ecstatically weeping at just a sort of a beauty beyond measure, which is the combined talents of so many gifted, brilliant singers and musicians and directors and stage designers all coming together to create something that exceeds its materials, literally something that is transcendent. And you know, going back to even the inspiration of wanting to talk to you, this has been something that for me has felt like my North Star since I was a little kid. I didn't know what the hell I wanted to do. I studied philosophy and film because movies were at least more reliably than other forms of art capable of evoking that feeling.
Yeah.
This sort of ecstatic, aesthetic radiance, you know? And then philosophy, like you, just a love of contending with what does this mean, you know what I mean? And bringing it to life. And so, wow, I don't even know what to say. I'm just in awe. But before we wrap up, I want to pivot a little bit because we've been going sacred. I want to go to profane again. Mm. Let's talk about the Madonna whore complex because... let me tell you why this is such a big switch, because this is the human condition. We started off talking about pooping and how we can't just fathom that human beings have to poop. And then we went and spent an hour talking about the stuff that clearly means a lot to us. But why is it that Freud said you can't love what you desire and you can't desire what you love? And how come feelings of tenderness and rapture and aesthetic ecstasy and the people we want to hold and just love forever, we sometimes can't sexually devour the ways in which we fantasize about when we're alone?
Look, I mean, I think, you know, Freud's great insight is that we learn about tenderness around people who we cannot have sex with. In other words, there is within families, within functioning families, a taboo around sexuality. So our earliest experience of love is people who love us deeply, make us feel amazing, but will not in any way stimulate us sexually.
Right.
And that's the way it should be. And that sets up a conundrum for adult life. Mm. Because suddenly, when we emerge as adults, we're supposed to do two relatively different things. A, gain sexual fulfillment from somebody, and B, bring to them all the resources of love and tenderness and loyalty, etc., to bear. And, you know, as generations upon generations have discovered, there tends to be an incompatibility. Now, what do we do with that incompatibility?
Right.
I think, like many of the things we've been talking about, accept it and not berate ourselves for it. You know, to see that this is not some personal failing. You know, my argument with, say, the kind of American marriage therapy industry is that it seems to pathologize this division. It seems to suggest that there is something fundamentally wrong. it's not wrong. It's just desperately inconvenient, but right. It's very natural.
Right.
And so, and the goal isn't to, you know, light candles and you know, go to hotels, etc. That may help a little bit, of course. Try that as you may. But to accept the kind of tragedy of and the complexity of being human, that not all good things belong within one setting. And maybe the bourgeois marriage, with its ideal that we can have our best friend, our, you know, ideal bureaucrat, co-parent, sexual partner, etc., and that this can be one person, not just for a little while, but forever, this is both amazingly beautiful and in 89% of cases, not realistic. Hmm. And so rather than constantly feeling, why am I abnormal, we should start have the courage to say, why have we trapped ourselves within a definition of normality which has left out so much of our reality and complexity? Rather than beating ourselves up, why don't we just admit there is nothing wrong with you? You know, if you've been married to the same person for 30 years and you don't feel a burning, desperate desire, you know, to make love to them, go back to the ancient Greeks. They had 5 or even 6, depending on how you define it, words for love. Right. So they knew that there was eros, and that eros meant the love that you feel very intensely at the beginning of a relationship. It's highly sexual. You want to take off their clothes. You want to explore their, you know, the heels of their feet. You want to possess every part of them. And then over time, that may give way to agape, which is a more tender, more sibling-like kind of friendship. And, you know, they were wise. They understood that that's what happens to everybody. And it's unfortunate that our word love is so restrictive, mm-hmm. and puts so many of the emotions that we feel outside of our kind of, you know, ordinary consciousness.
Hmm. Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to say.
So there's no answer.
Yeah,
there's no easy answer.
Yeah,
but there's no easy answer. Mm. Why are you wrestling with this in life, in your life?
Well, you know, that's yeah, I have, yeah. I have for sure, because. Because so much of what I value is what we've spent the entire hour of this right. podcast speaking about. I mean, right. just in beauty, in truth, in radiance, in aesthetics, in sense making, in storytelling, in losing myself in art. I mean, that's sort of, I live for that. But I also, I have a sex drive, and sometimes what I sort of desire in a carnal fashion is something that even among, you know, women that I've been in love with, I sort of feel a kind of embarrassment about. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And I know it's not rational, and it all should be fine, or even sometimes just what I don't desire.
Yeah, you know? But I think, you know, so it's the beginning of great art and great conversation and great friendship is to be able to go there,
yeah.
and not to pathologize yourself.
I mean,
what you've just outlined there is, you know, millions of people out there will relate to that.
Yeah.
This is part of the story of being human, that we're still gathering the courage to tell ourselves and to tell our partners
to show ourselves
with love.
Yeah.
We don't have the words still. We don't have the confidence to say, is this some curse that I was born with? Is there something, you know, so wrong with me? As a general rule, when you feel I must be the only one with this thing, I really have a personal curse, just statistically, this cannot be true. You are probably mainlining on the truth of millions of people at precisely that moment.
Mm.
How can there still be a silence around this, given the internet, given art, given the... We're still at the dawn of fully understanding what it means to be human. I know that sounds weird, because we're supposed to be at the end of history. We're not. We're still getting going as human beings.
Yeah.
And I think we're only beginning still to understand our sexuality and the psychology of love. It's still just beginning.
And that there's maybe parts of ourselves that are just wired that way and perhaps can't be changed, because, you know, it's like there's so many... sort of self-help, like take this 4-day course in embodied sacred sexuality and it'll cure all your ills, you know, and
right.
people say, yeah, this changed my life, and we found, you know, and I'm a little bit like snake oil to the cynic is often holy water to the eager, you know, like so much of that is placebo and expectation, this and that, but it's like certain things feel like have solutions and certain things I worry have no solution, and that kind of leaves me.
But I think, you know, when we say no solutions, there are always, I mean, death has no solution, but we have ways, as we were talking, of kind of consoling ourselves and reconciling ourselves. So yes, there are serious incompatibilities within love and desire, and the bourgeois marriage is not the solution for anyone. Some people manage to keep it going. Some people manage to, you know, live with its stresses and strains. But I would wish for them to be honest with themselves and their partners about what those strains are. And that was also the beginning of a wonderful kind of intimacy. I mean, I know a couple who've been married for years, and they will honestly admit to each other the longings and the sacrifices that they've made to be together. And it's beautiful to see them, because you see that these are people who are getting a friendship around some of the tragedies that their relationship has entailed. And you could say that's not very romantic, but yes, it is to admit to a partner, I love you, but you kind of ruined my life. And they can go, you know, I love you too, but fuck you, because in a way you have too. That's romantic in a weird way. Yes. That is a kind of really deep and dark intimacy.
I think, so good. It reminds me of a scene from Before Midnight, Richard Linklater's great film. Oh, yes, exactly. So, you know, he says to her, I fucked up my whole life because of the way you sing. Yeah, and it's kind of romantic, because you remember from the second film when she was like playing the guitar. That's what I'm not going back. I'm divorcing my wife. I'm staying here with you. And it's funny. Maybe we can end on that trilogy as we wrap our conversations, because the first film is this opens up a space in which I thought I wanted to live in forever. The first film is the feeling of meeting somebody. They take your breath away. You get off the train in a city neither of you know. So you're in a mythopoetic altered state of consciousness together. And the night feels like it's outside of time. And everything about it is, I could fall in love inside this moment. I want to live inside this pop song. I want to see beautiful art with you and explore the insides of your soul. And then the end of that movie is the ultimate in bittersweet, because it's dawn. Mm. And then he recites the W.H. Auden poem to her, and all the clocks in the city began to whir and chime. Oh, let not time deceive you. You cannot conquer time. Headaches and in worries, vaguely life leaks away, and time will have its fancy tomorrow or today. And then they're walking around an alley, and somebody's playing a harp in the apartment, and he stops, and they dance to the harpsichord, and then he stops her, and she just looks so beautiful, like she's just this, she's a woman in love. And he pauses her, and he goes, and he fakes like a fake camera. He's like, I want to take a picture of you and all this, so I never forget you and I never forget this. And that moment is so heartbreaking, and I feel like I've been in rebellion my entire life against accepting that that moment will pass.
And I think that it doesn't have to pass with, I mean, you can keep that moment going in your life. You can keep having those experiences. Right. It's a choice. You know, there are costs to that kind of life. You may at certain points feel lonely, feel without a home, without a hearth, without the fire, you know. We're also creatures that like a fire.
That's
that
true.
Like our home.
For sure.
And you may feel the absence of that. Yeah. So you have the adventure, you know, your Ulysses out there in the high seas, but you're longing for Ithaca.
That's right.
And at the same time, you know, what's the alternative? To just stay in Ithaca. And that can be dull too, because it's day after day, it's the routine. So whatever choice you make, there will be suffering and longing. In one direction or another, there will be something incomplete. That helps a lot, to know that the incompleteness is endemic to the human animal. In the same way that we have parts to our brains, we have parts to our ambitions, and they don't all pull in one direction. There is no path that reconciles all our longings, you know, and...
So you don't believe in Roland Barthes' notion of moments in which all of my desires are abolished in the plenitude of their satisfaction?
No, I believe in moments, but I don't believe in years.
Got it.
I don't believe in decades. I 100% believe in moments.
Okay, perfect.
But we don't live in moments. We live in decades.
Well, I've been trying to live in moments.
Right.
That's my curse and my blessing. That's my life. That's why I'm sometimes lonely and I don't have a fixed home.
Yeah.
Because I'm living moment. I'm trying to live moment to moment.
And we're interested in your experiment.
Sure.
You know,
we'll see what happens. We'll see.
And I think your temperament, it makes you ideally suited to that. And you may be one of the, you know, you are a rare individual in that case. And keep that going. Uh-huh. And you know,
you keep it going too.
Because you know, we each have our own thing we do. Anyway.
Well, it's so funny. We started off talking about incompleteness and we're ending talking about incompleteness. So Alain de Botton, thank you. You are one of my heroes. I'm happy you exist. I take great refuge in your writing. Just thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, thank you. You are an incredibly positive force in the universe. Oh. It's been a great joy. Thank you.